Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
If your church moved to a new location, would the old neighborhood want the address? We'll talk about it today on Connecting Faith. Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross along with me, Carissa Rogers, and we're not, Ted, actually going to talk about churches moving to new locations, but
okay. But
the reality is that culture has moved, and is the church, you know, still in the neighborhood?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, you can't do the same old, and expect the same results, right?
At the same time, we don't want to move away from the gospel because we've seen sort of plenty of that.
Yeah, so you need to have an anchor and a foundation to stick to.
Today we're going to address the question, Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church. It's the latest book from Tom Rainer, who's president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources. Love the opportunity to talk with Tom. And we're going to talk about that and a number of other things as well. He'll get some of his reflections on the events of this past week and, you know, the tensions in which our country is living in. And I don't know about you, Ted, you just kind of think in terms of top of mind, you know, a lot of expressions of protest around the nation.
Mm-hmm. Traffic being shut down even in the Twin Cities this morning.
Yeah.
I missed it by 5 minutes. I beat it by 5 minutes, as you could say, but... Yeah,
it's sort of a, you know, does that really accomplish? What does that really accomplish? I think we wonder.
Mm-hmm.
The president's going to host a town hall tomorrow, I think. You know, that'll be of some value. You know,
sure.
Hopefully it'll be, you know, good to have some dialogue. But, you know, what will that ultimately accomplish? And so I just was thinking about, you know, where do we turn in times of trouble? And I thought about that verse in Psalm 50, verse 15. Where God says, this is just after he's talked about, you know, I'm God, there's no other, I don't have any need of, you know, bulls from your stall or sacrifices, goats from their pens, every animal in the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills, I know every bird in the mountains and the creatures of the field are mine, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. And then he goes on to say, sacrifice thank offerings to God, fulfill your vows to the Most High, he says, and call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you will honor me. God gets glory when we call on him, and he shows himself strong and delivers us.
Mm.
There's a gathering this weekend in Washington, D.C., that it seems more timely than ever when it was first envisioned. Nick Hall and the team of young evangelists and believers said, we should just get together to pray in Washington, D.C., and so they're calling it Together 2016. Because they believe that Jesus changes everything. And he says, our generation is the most cause-driven in history, but our causes are pulling us apart. Even religion doesn't unite. And that's certainly true, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we believe that only Jesus can bring us together. And so that's what they're asking believers to be a part of coming up this Saturday. And I thought we'd just hear a couple minutes from Nick right now.
And so the question we've asked is, man, could it be that God is doing something so significant that he's inviting us as a nation, calling us to gather to seek him for one day in one place? And we really believe that place is our nation's capital. The National Mall was set aside by our government as the gathering place for the nation. And so for people, I've just been asking, man, is there room in your agenda for God to call an audible? Some people say, oh, I plan out long in advance. Listen, is there room in our agenda for God to say, listen, this might not have been in your master plan, but it's been in my master plan, and I'm intending to do something, and I want to invite you to be there. National Mall, July 16th, we're going to seek Jesus together and pray for God to do what only God can do.
When we hear a gathering in Washington, D.C., we often think, well, there must be some sort of political ramifications or that we're making a statement. But so how do you respond to that?
You know, I mean, we are making a statement. I mean, there's no question. You can't be in a city like that and not think about those things. But for us, the statement is we need Jesus. If any statement we're trying to make is that politics aren't the answer, you know, and that's not to say that we don't need politics. We shouldn't pray for godly leaders. That's biblical. But really, the only agenda is Jesus. And so we're coming together across lines, across denominations, coming together believing that Jesus, you're the leader we need. You're the answer we need. You are the hope of the nations. And so we're praying for a supernatural reset in our day and say, you know what? Our hope is in heaven. We're going to gather. We're going to seek God because he promises when we put him first, when we prioritize him first, that he honors that and he will bless us. He'll heal us. He'll forgive us. And ultimately, it's about treasure. I mean, we're saying, God, our treasure is in you. Our hope is in you. Our love is for you. And so that's the goal. And yeah, so man, we want to make a statement to everybody. We need Jesus. And the answer is Jesus. And the time is now to seek Jesus. So let's come together and let's see what God can do.
Well, it's pretty simple, but yet profound. It could truly be a gathering of significant outcome as believers from literally around the country, around the globe, in fact, are gathering in Washington, D.C. this Saturday. You can find out more about it, reset2016.com, reset2016.com. I recommend you to look into it and maybe be praying in your neighborhood and in your church if you don't have an opportunity to be there in D.C. to be part of that great gathering. And we're talking about gatherings that we have in our communities. The word, I think the original Greek word was just a gathering of people. It has become the word church, and we've sort of thought about it as a building. We're going to talk church today. I always love the opportunity to talk with Tom Rayner. Tom is president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources. He's one of the largest Christian resource companies in the world. He's a respected pastor and researcher. He's written more than, I think, two dozen books. And today he is going to talk with us a little bit about his latest called Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church. He's written books like Simple Church and I Am a Church Member. And he and his wife, Nellie Jo, have three grown sons and several grandchildren. And we're honored to have him back with us on Connecting Faith. Tom, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Thanks. I'm always glad to be with you guys. You make it fun.
Well, that's now the pressure's on us, so we'll see what we can do. Ted does the fun stuff, so I'm going to just leave it to him.
All right.
You know, before we, you know, we'll have some fun in our discussion, but probably just to talk a little bit about, I know the new book has been the result of a lot of on-the-ground research from a number of churches. And I know you talk regularly with pastors. You're writing regularly. I always appreciate what you write. And just thinking about the events of this past week or so, that pointed out that, you know, maybe the legal system really isn't the venue to bring about the peace and health in our society that we'd hope for. What do you hear from pastors and church leaders as you talk about maybe new ways to address the brokenness in our culture?
You know, one of the principles of leadership is unintended consequences. You ask, if this happens, what are some possible outcomes that we may not have considered? I don't want to suggest for a moment that the shootings and whether it be an individual or the law enforcement officers, that any of those are good events. But there has been, and I think what I would have seen as an unintended consequence of this that is extremely positive. And the positive that is coming out of this has been a wake-up call for many slumbering churches and many slumbering leaders in churches. Many of our churches are not involved or impacting the community in which they're located. They've become insulated, maybe isolated. They've become more like a religious country club than the true New Testament church. And what I've seen just anecdotally in the last week is coming out in the most positive way of church leaders and churches where they're saying, hey, you know what, we're to the point now where we understand that new legislation is not going to make our nation better. We understand that a presidential decree won't turn things around. We understand that the latest governmental fix or anything from a human perspective is not going to do what needs to be done. And they're saying, God, please help us through our church to be a change agent in the community for good. And we're hearing, and it's only been a few days, but I hear from dozens of pastors every day through every kind of means, from social media to the blog to on like that. And they're telling me, I really haven't paid much attention to my community. I haven't asked the question, what can I do for good? And what they're seeing is that their own community is a microcosm of what the nation is and what the world is. And if they can affect change with the gospel, if they can affect true biblical change in the community, then they're making a change in the world. When you look around at most of our educational institutions, most of our health facilities, their origins were the church. The church cared for the community. Government and private organizations have taken them over for the most part. But maybe I'm too much of an obnoxious optimist, but I am really thinking that now we're going to see more and more church leaders truly fall on their face before God and ask the question, what can I do to make a difference in this community, to make a difference for the world? Maybe that's a lot more than you were asking when you ask a very simple question of what you're hearing, but I'm kind of in the overflow after listening to so many church leaders right now.
Tom, you recently blogged about and shared some comments from one of your associates about how do we help our kids talk about racial injustice. Maybe just share a key thought or two from that before we go on to talk about leading change in the church.
Well, that blog post, of course, was written by one of my favorite guys that talks about family and marriage. His name is Josh Straub, and Josh is just on the cutting edge of helping families to understand. And basically, Josh says we've got to educate ourselves. We've got to have the facts down. We cannot just get into hyperbole about what some talking head is saying on a cable newscast. We've got to demonstrate compassion. When our children see us being compassionate, they then are compassionate too. And then we've got to speak truth. Now, how we communicate truth is different for every age. And one of the great things that Josh does in this particular blog post is he says, okay, let's look at the different age groups and let's talk about how you can communicate with them. I won't get into those details right now, but just simply to say there's a way to communicate for young, middle, and older children, and he does a great job in that blog post of doing so.
Speaking of blog posts, if people want to read what you're writing regularly, where could they find that?
Tom Rainer, that's T-H-O-M. I spell my name weirdly, T-H-O-M Rainer, R-A-I-N-E-R.com. And that's actually the place where you'll find the blog, the podcast, and the books. So it's kind of the gathering place for all that I do.
Glad that Tom Rainer has carved out a little time to gather with us today on Connecting Faith. We're going to talk about his new book, Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church. And we've got a little roadmap to how we might remain faithful to the core convictions of the gospel while being more effective in living out the faith in our communities. More on that coming up with Tom Rainer, President and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources. He's authored more than 24 books, including Autopsy of a Deceased Church, A Simple Life, Simple Church, The Millennials. We've got half a dozen copies of Tom's book to give away and some of his other resources as well, and we'd love to be able to put a resource in your hand today. And you can sign up for that by calling 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. We do a drawing at the top of the hour whenever we have resources to give away. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, if your church moved to a new location, would the old neighborhood want the address? We're not really going to talk about church relocation, but we're talking about how things move and change. Talking change and leading change in the church today with Tom Rainer. Stay tuned for more. World changers. That's what God has called us to be salt and light, to have an impact. But how do we do that when the world has maybe changed more rapidly than our churches? I'm almost probably guaranteed of that. The question addressed in the new book called Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church, the latest from Tom Rainer. Tom's best-selling author. He's a pastor, a researcher, and president of and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources, joining us today. Tom, I was thinking about as I was looking at the book, David Jeremiah from the Turning Point broadcast, he says, he talks about their mission is to teach the never-changing word to an ever-changing world. And that's a nice statement, but it seems increasingly complicated to accomplish. So let's talk about what it is.
Leadership is increasingly complicated, particularly in the North American church. We're at a point right now, and I said at the top of this particular show when it first came on that I really am an obnoxious optimist, and I'm beginning to see some signs of church leaders beginning to do things that really are absolutely amazing to me. But there is a stark reality that we need to confront as well. 90% of churches, and it's slightly above 90, but just for simplicity's sake, 9 out of 10 churches are either declining in North America or they're growing at a pace that is slower than the community in which they're located. Or a simple way of saying that is 9 out of 10 churches are losing ground in their community. That's but one statistic, and that's a numerical statistic, and while numbers aren't everything, I think that is telling. So we're at a point now where change is paramount, not change of the gospel that is forever, not change of the word of God. It is unchangeable. But how we do, what we do in the culture and where we are doing it, we have to change in so many ways and contextualize in so many ways that if we don't, the projection of 100,000 churches in the United States closing in the next decade will become a reality, because we're currently at 7,000 a year. It wouldn't take much to get that to 10,000 a year, or thus 100,000 in a decade.
Wow, that's a pretty sobering statistic. You address early on in the book, we talk about change, and we say, well, a lot of it falls on leadership, but you do address the unmovable church member, and we want to avoid being one of those. Talk about those.
Well, we have to start with the reality of where we are in many of our churches. And sometimes I write a bit too bluntly. I get myself in trouble. As a matter of fact, I had a blog post that I had submitted to my assistant. She does the proofreading of it once I'm done. And she came back and she said, "You don't want to post this one." And it is really rare for her to say that. And I read it again. I said, "You're exactly right. I don't want to post this one." So I can be a little bit straightforward. That's what a former pastor can do. If you're a current pastor, it's a little bit more difficult than that. And I talk about the different types of so-called immovable members. There's the denier. The denier is one that just simply says there's nothing wrong with our church. I give an example in the book, but there's more than one of those metaphorical ostriches with their head in the sand in our church. Everything is absolutely fine. The one that I think that grates against me more than any other is the entitled, where church membership has more of a country club favor to it. I pay my dues, and so I'm entitled. I want my church this way. I want these things going this way. Of course, it's a totally unbiblical model, but when you have entitled church members, the first thing that has to change is that mindset. They're the blamers, and many times that blamer points right to the pastor or to other leaders. Our church would be more evangelistic if the pastor just did this or that, and the list could go on and on. But the finger points in those cases at everywhere but themselves. Of course, there's always the critics, and the critics are those who are sometimes sincere in their criticism, and we need to heed that. And then there are those who are just nitpicking. And I talk about the past, P-A-S-T, critic who starts it with people are saying that, P-A-S-T, which is another one that grates on my nerves, where they use some fictitious other person to describe the criticism. And then finally, the confused. And those are usually well-intending church members, but they don't understand why the world is changing so rapidly. And for them, the church is a place of stability. Yes, it is on those things that matter, but the confusion comes when things of a methodological or a cultural issue begin to change. and they don't understand why that is necessary. So those are five types, and I speak in hyperbole to say unmovable, but I would simply say that those are the types of obstacles that you might face with some of your church members.
Well, maybe as we've heard those, doing a little self-assessment, say, okay, I could make some changes on some of those areas, aspects in my life, because I think we all have those aspects from time to time. One of the things you talk about kind of in a roadmap to leading your church in change is you talk about communicating a sense of urgency, but you also talk about stopping and praying. It seems like those two steps maybe seem like they're in contradiction.
They could be. And if you have to choose between the two, stop and pray. Okay. Stop and pray. Because otherwise you're going to get out ahead of God. I have yet to see any type of sustained change in a church that was not so bathed in prayer that everybody who has a relationship with God through Christ is talking about it, and it's where people are praying for it in groups. The church is praying for it, maybe as a congregation. Maybe it's too early at this point. Certainly the staff is coming together, elders, deacons, everybody is taking time to pray. Yes, you need to communicate a sense of urgency. Yes, you need to move quickly. But moving so quickly that you leave God out of the picture is foolish, unbiblical, and unfruitful. So when it's all said and done, you pray, and then you say, hey, guys, hey, ladies, if we don't make these changes, here is where we will be, say, 10 years from now or 5 years from now. And it's not just a concern about our local church. It's what are we doing here? What are we doing as believers in Christ gathered together in this local manifestation called the church? What is our purpose? Why do we exist? And anytime you begin to ask those questions, that's a sense of urgency. The Great Commission is a sense of urgency that we're to go and make disciples of all people groups or nations. It's an imperative that exists from the first century AD to 2016 today. So prayer, yes. Urgency once you have prayed significantly and continue to pray.
Tom Rainer is guest today. He's president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources, and he's a respected pastor and researcher. He's written more than 2 dozen books and has several bestsellers, including I Am a Church Member. Rainer and his wife have 3 grown sons, several grandchildren. They live in Nashville, and Tom writes regularly. Great insight, even though he is optimistic, he also tells it like it is. So I know you'll appreciate reading his writing. You can find more at tomrainer.com. That's TOMRainer.com. And we're going to talk more with Tom in a moment about his latest book, Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church. We've got some copies to give away. Great reading, as always, from Tom. And you can get a copy, sign up for that at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And if you'd like to join in with a question, I always love to hear your thoughts, your comments on that as well, and maybe some takeaways. So join with us. We'll talk more with Tom Rainer in just a moment. We'll talk about some low-hanging fruit and how do we make a difference in the churches that maybe aren't being as effective as they could be. All those things coming up in the next couple minutes. Stay tuned to Connecting Faith.
Shine, make them wonder what you got. Make a wish that they were not.
Talking today about church, about letting the light shine. Jesus' light, his design was that his body would be his representatives, his ambassadors. And, you know, the society, culture is moving, changing rapidly. And so are we still being relevant and attractive and truly making a difference in our communities? We're addressing it from a new book from Tom Rainer called Who Moved My Pulpit? Leading Change in the Church. Tom's written several best-selling books, and I read what he writes. I always appreciate his writing. He blogs regularly at tomrainer.com, and you can find out more about the books there as well. He's president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources. And we're talking today about church change. One of the things you talk about in a sort of roadmap to leading change and, you know, maybe not just for churches, but for ministry organizations as well. But you talk about getting a coalition of committed people. And I'm wondering, you know, how big does that coalition need to be? Is a small group of committed folks enough for change to take place?
Quantity should not be the number one. Quality should be. And by quality, I don't mean that you will have better people in a character sense than others, but the quality would be the most influential. I recommend to, for example, a new pastor going into a church, before anything begins to happen, is to find out who are the ones that when they speak, people listen. Many years ago, there was a commercial about a brokerage firm, E.F. Hutton, and they had this line, when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. And whenever someone was making some type of comment about E.F. Hutton, the commercial would go quiet as if everyone was listening. Every church has those influencers. You can ask around to just a few people, like, hey, who are the true influencers in the church, or who are those that you want to make sure on board before any change takes place? And usually it is a few more likely than a lot. In a large church, it's probably a few. In a small church, it's probably a few. They may not have formal titles. They may. They may be elders. They may be deacons. They may not be. They may be some key staff. In one of the churches, I'm no longer a pastor, but when I served as a pastor several years ago, the key influencer in the church was a senior adult lady that was also one of the most powerful intercessory prayer warriors I've ever known. And though she would not for one moment suggest that she was influencer or power broker or anything of that nature, she was too humble for that, I knew in that church that I never did anything without talking to her first, not only because she was an influencer that could help me move it in the direction, but because I thought she was so in touch with God that if I was going in the wrong direction, she'd be the first to tell me. So the direct answer to your question is it's usually smaller. It does not have to be, but it's usually a smaller group and not a larger group.
Yeah, of course, I guess those influencers can sometimes work against change as well, right? That's one of the big challenges.
Well, if they do, you have one or two. You have some choices. We'll put it that way. One choice is to try to get them on board, try to persuade them for a change. Another choice is to go against them, and that is many times unfruitful, and a third choice is just to wait. I was talking to a pastor who was about to lead in a significant building program. I thought the church needed it from a facility point of view for several reasons, but there was a key influencer in that church that was just adamant that the time was wrong. And the pastor decided without this key influencer, he hated to give one person veto power, but without this one person, the congregation would be in a more questioning mode than enthusiastic mode. And so he waited, and several months later, the negative person, the one that was not ready to get on board, came to him and said, let's talk about it. And now they're in the process of getting on the same page and moving forward. I think that was a wise time to wait.
You know, in your book, Who Moved My Pulpit, you talk about low-hanging fruit. What's the low-hanging fruit that we're missing?
Low-hanging fruit is a change that you can make that will cause little disruption. There may not be an expense associated with it. There may be. One of the more recent examples, I have two of my three sons are pastors. One is with a vice president of a seminary, so they're all in vocational ministry. But my son, who's a pastor of a church in Bradenton, Florida, is getting ready to lead the church through, from my perspective, some minor changes, mainly renovating a worship center. And it's not always buildings, by the way, but in this case, it's an antiquated building. They don't have a sufficient foyer, and there are a few other things that he thinks are necessary that I agree with him. But everybody in the church that I've talked to, I've been there a few times, and everybody I talked to said, oh, we've been waiting on this. This is something we want. It's low-hanging fruit because there is a strong consensus that has already been built for this change. And if you lead in that change, it's easy. That's why I refer to it as low-hanging fruit. It's something that's ready to be picked, and it's easy to be picked. That's change, but it is change with little discontent in the church, and it's change that moves the church forward with more enthusiasm, whereas makes the next change which may not be low-hanging fruit, a more possible and likely change.
You call us to the church to make a difference, and I'm just, I guess, maybe as you said at the outset, based on statistics, that we're maybe not making a difference. So what should that look like ideally?
Well, one of the questions that I would ask, and again, I don't think that there is a single answer to your question. I mean, we could talk about evangelism, discipleship, ministry, worship, fellowship, and we could keep on going down the list about what a healthy church looks like. But one of the key questions I ask, I usually do not ask people in the church. I used to do a lot of consultations in the past, and I would begin my consultation by going to people around the church, typically a merchant. And one vivid testimony was I went to a convenience store that was on one corner diagonally from the church. And I just simply went in and asked the question, how do I get to this church? And they said they'd never heard of it. Well, I just pointed to them from where they were talking to me. I said, there it is right there. It was within eyeshot of them as they talked to me, but they didn't even know the church was there. So to answer your question directly, a church that is making a difference is first going to know that difference is made clearly in its Acts 1:8 Jerusalem. Certainly, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth, all of them, but it begins with making a difference in your community. And how would I know that you're making a difference? The community is telling me the church is making a difference. So that's where I would begin by answering your question.
You recently posted a blog about 10 traits of a healthy church 10 years from now. And one of those things you talked about being rooted in the community, and we just sort of touched on that. But we're kind of, many of us, I guess, in the kind of commuter church mode, right? So is that likely to change? And does that mean that we can't have an influence in the community?
I think it is likely to change. And that doesn't mean you cannot have influence in the community. It's just a little bit tougher because you're not living in the community with the people who might be more inclined to come to the church. It's possible, but it's a little more difficult. But here's a couple of things that are happening. One of the reasons I think we're seeing more and more multi-campus churches is a desire for churches to have more locations that are actually in the community instead of the one place where it is a magnet, whether it's a mega church or a large church, for everybody to come. I think that that is more of a desire for a community-centric church. Another thing that we're seeing, and I'm keeping an eye on this, is we're seeing what I would call an optimum attendance size, and I'm reticent to say optimum because that implies too many things, but in terms of evangelistic effectiveness and assimilation, we're seeing churches somewhere in the 300 to 400 attendance being the most effective in evangelism and assimilation. That tells me that we're probably going to have more mid-sized churches embedded within communities in the future than we are the large mega church you're attracting from several places and several destinations. That is counterintuitive right now, and it's counter to the statistics. More people are moving to the large churches now. I am seeing some, at least early signs, that we'll see more moving to the mid-sized churches in the future.
We started out talking a little bit about our racial challenges and the brokenness in our culture. In the blog posting about 10 traits of a healthy church 10 years from now, you referenced diversity. And I'm just wondering if you can, maybe we can circle back to that, because we hear, and I don't know if it's true, but the statistic about Sunday morning's most undiverse hour of the week, if that's true, how do we go about changing that?
You are quoting an old quote by Donald McGavran back in the 1950s. 11 o'clock is the most segregated hour in America, and it was in a book dealing with what was then called the homogeneous unit principle. I think it is still a largely segregated, but I do think it is changing as well. If a leader was to come to me and say, Tom, I want our church to more reflect the community, and let's just say that the community is equally, as an example, one-third Hispanic, one-third African-American, and one-third Anglo, he would say, where do I begin? My response is, the people that you see on the platform, the preachers, the worship leaders, anybody on the platform is going to make a huge statement to how diverse your church is or how diverse you want your church to be. So one of the first steps I would make is to make certain I had visible leadership that represented other ethnic groups, if that is part of the true heart of the church.
How do we, I guess, define a healthy church or, a successful church? Talk about, we want to be healthy 10 years from now. What is the key to that? We all have, our sins and shortcomings.
I did write this blog post back on July 11th about 10 traits of the healthiest churches 10 years from now, and some of the commenters really jumped my case. I can't expect it because I don't put assumptions in there. And, I assume any time that I am writing something like this that there are some non-negotiables: preaching of the word, teaching of the word, daily reading of the word, prayer, fasting, sharing of the gospel, and on like that. Well, I didn't put those assumptions in there, and I said, here are 10 characteristics of healthy churches in the future. Man, you're not even talking about preaching the word. You don't believe in the word. You're not even talking about evangelism. So I had to go in the comments and say, no, I'm building upon those kinds of foundations. So when you ask the question, what is a healthy church? Well, a healthy church is first a church that is preaching the word and truth. It is doctrinally sound. It is doctrinally pure. So you have to begin with that foundation. But then you ask the question, is it living up to the mandates that Christ has given us? And, of course, some of those mandates go right back to the Great Commission, which is not merely an evangelistic mandate. It's a disciple-making mandate. So does the church have people coming as new Christians, and are they being truly discipled within the church? One of the big trends that we're seeing in churches that has really come on the last 15 years is the presence of new member classes or some similar name. And the purpose of those is to bring people in the church, not only give them information about the church, but expectation about what it means to be a part of God's local church. And in that sense, we're seeing more people stick to the church. Assimilation is taking place. If they stay, what happens? They're more likely to be in small groups. They're more likely to be in ministry. And they're more likely to contribute to the health of the church.
There can be great days ahead if we are committed to staying with the basics and looking at ways that we can change and grow and be more connected with our communities and with each other. Tom Rainer has been writing and teaching about church leadership for many years. He's president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources and a best-selling author, a pastor, and a researcher, and we're honored to have him with us for a few minutes today. Tom, blessings to you. I want to just encourage people to go to your website. I know that in the book you do have a change readiness inventory for churches, so it seems like it would be a good resource for a church leadership to look into as well.
Right, exactly. And it's something that can be self-scored, and it can be done by the church as a whole. It can be done by an individual with his or her own opinion.
Mm. Well, thanks for sharing your opinion, Tom, and we look forward to you continue writing and a chance to visit down the road again.
Always, thank you for allowing me to be on your show.
Tom Rainer is my guest today. Find out more on his website, tomrainer.com. That's T-H-O-M, tomrainer.com.
Nothing shall be impossible. Your kingdom reigns unstoppable. We'll shout your praise forevermore. Jesus, our God, unstoppable. Your praise forever.
favorite new anthems over the last couple of years or so. I think it really spells out the reality that when that we as God's people get empowered by God's Spirit, that there can be a change in the atmosphere and in our communities. Build Your Kingdom is a great tune from Wren Collective. It's part of the program here on Connecting Faith where we do a little takeaway, a little feedback, what we learned. We welcome you, by the way, if you have some thoughts, some takeaway thoughts that you're reflecting on as a result of our conversation with Tom Rainer. You can call us at 877-933-2484. But let's talk takeaways.
Yeah, you know, Neil, what stood out for me was that low-hanging fruit analogy. I mean, you don't have to do grand things. I mean, a lot of times we talk about change. What can I do to change the culture? And, you know, we want to see certain things change in the culture, but that's a big task sometimes. And it's done in the small things step by step. That was a wonderful thing that he said about that.
I think what stood out to me, you guys, is when he was sharing this story about asking the local the gentleman at the convenience store if where the church was, and the guy had no idea what he was talking about. So that was really convicting and also affirming in knowing that the church I belong to, we do tend to take the grassroots approach and go door to door and passing out flyers and whatnot. So, yeah, it is important that, you know, change starts from within, and so that we can be motivated by what Tom was sharing with us today to go out into our local communities and be the light.
You know, just something you said right toward the end caught my attention, and he was reminding us that there's a resurgence of kind of new member classes, those kinds of things going mm-hmm. on, and in those, it's not only information but expectations that we've sort of, for I think a few years, sort of dropped that idea of, and of course Tom has written about in a great book called "I Am a Church Member." He said, "What does it mean to be a part of a local body?" And said that there are some expectations.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. I know in my church we have four questions that we ask new members as they go in front of the congregation, and we pray for them. And it's, are you willing to be active in at least one activity outside of the services, and are you willing to volunteer for something at least once a year and tithe and things like that? And they publicly acknowledge that. And then we pray for them, and they're in, sure. So, yeah, it's important to have some kind of accountability of sorts, I guess, that way, and commitment.
Yeah, and I would also say if you're noticing in your church there's not so many opportunities to be the hands and feet of Jesus, to be the change agent, to bring it up to the church leaders or be a leader yourself and just try to introduce an opportunity in the community and get other people to jump on board.
Don't have to wait for leadership to come up with the ideas. You can take the lead. Sometimes that can be done in a smaller setting. Obviously, small groups are important. But we have a talk in church from a little different perspective now with some thoughts from Carl Vaders. Carl was on with us some time ago, and we were talking about, he's written a book called The Grasshopper Myth, Big Churches, Small Churches, and the Small Thinking That Divides Us. And he talks about, some of the value of a small church. Let's listen in.
It's really easy for a congregation member to look at a pastor on the stage on the platform and think, wow, they're really doing something for the kingdom of God. And it's just as easy for a small church pastor to look at a big church pastor in the big church down the street and go, wow, they're really doing something for the kingdom of God. I'm smaller, so I must not be important. But the fact is, we're all different parts of the body. You're called to be a hand, I'm called to be a foot or a big toenail or something. So I'll play my part, and I won't be jealous of the part that Christ has called somebody else or some other church to play.
Are there things that maybe small churches offer or that bigger churches can't or don't, or things that the small church is maybe uniquely positioned to be effective in ministry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the benefits of the big church are fairly obvious. They, big resources, they can offer a ton of options. There's all kinds of great things that big churches can offer. And I want to say this real quick. I'm not anti-big church. I love big churches. You get 3,000 people together to worship Jesus. How's that not anything but great? I just also am in favor of 3,000 people worshiping Jesus in 30 to 40 small churches as well. They're both good. So let me just say that. But, yeah, there are a handful of things that small churches can do better than big churches can. And you really see it when you talk to small church people about why they go to a small church. As an example, most small church people will say, in a small church, I know the pastor. I can call the pastor. The pastor can visit me. And there are people who want to be pastored by their pastor. And that's not a bad thing. Now, when that gets to a place where, hey, the church is growing, and now they're at 300, and the pastor can't pastor everybody, and they get upset and want the church to stay small, well, that's a problem. But to choose to go to a smaller church because they can have that one-on-one touch and they can actually call a pastor, that's not a bad thing to want to be pastored by your pastor. So that's one thing a small church can do well. Another thing a small church can do well is people who don't have quite as much obvious skill in ministry get a chance to help out a little more. As an example, in a smaller church, in a big church, if you're still learning to play guitar, you're never going to find yourself on the stage leading in worship. But in a lot of small churches, if you will step up and bang out those six chords, they will gladly welcome you and put you in charge. And you'll get great benefit in doing that. You'll bless the church by doing that. And because you're stepping up on the platform every week to lead people in worship, you tend to get better at it faster. So you have a real opportunity to accelerate your gift and to utilize it much, much earlier in a small church. And that's not just for onstage things. That's for all kinds of things. You can start being used at a lower level of skill, and then your skill level has a chance to increase much more dramatically and much more quickly. So that's another advantage of the small church.
Carl Vader's another writer that I like to read whatever he's writing. He had a great article in Christianity Today just the other day. Check it out, Carl Vader's, V-A-T-E-R-S. You can hear that whole interview from Connecting Faith. Go into our show page, Connecting Faith, at myfaithradio.com. Another thing that we can all do is pray more effectively.
I feel like doing anything without prayer is like trying to chop down a tree with an axe handle.
Have you discovered the difference that prayer can have on your neighborhood? Today on Making Your Life Count, Debbie McGoldrick says caring enough to pray for your neighbors is where it all begins.
My next door neighbor's house went up for sale, and a young married couple moved in. And over time, the wife came to know Christ. And really, through her coming to Christ, her husband came back to the faith.
It wasn't long before Debbie realized she was an answer to prayer.
They invited my husband and I to dinner to introduce them to their parents. And the husband's mother took me aside with tears streaming down her face, said, "I've been praying that my son would come back to Christ."
Changed life stories. We all love them, don't we? For more, go to CRU.org. That's CRU.org.
Speaking of prayer, we have a great opportunity to pray on our website. You can find out about prayer works. And at the bottom of the home page, you can share prayer requests there if there's a need. You can also join our prayer team. Love to have you be a part of that at myfaithradio.com and just the /prayer. And to be a part of the team that supports and prays for this ministry, we'd be grateful and honored to have you stand with us in that way. Hey, tomorrow, Ted, we're going to have a great conversation. We're going to talk cold cases with a detective.
A real-life sleuth.
Yes, yeah. It's going to be good. All the CSI fans, tomorrow's your show.
Yeah, that's right. So. J. Warner Wallace, great guy, very knowledgeable, and investigated faith for himself and came out a Christian, right?
Cold Case Christianity, a homicide detective investigates the claims of the Gospels. And we'll talk a variety of things, but obviously make some great insights about how we can be confident in who Jesus is and the reality of the resurrection and more. So, Cold Case Christianity tomorrow. Would love to have you join us here in Connecting Faith. Love to have you sign up, be part of our Live Free Challenge. You can get all that online at myfaithradio.com, and you can also hear past programs here of Connecting Faith as well at our show page, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.